And we welcome you back as in the spotlight today. We shine it on Gregory Pfeiffer. He is the author of Russians, The People Behind the Power, from 12 books. And let me tell you, this is an excellent read, and it's so timely. First of all, Gregory Pfeiffer, I want to welcome you to our program. It is great to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, first things first here, when you put pen to paper here, and this isn't your first go-around here, or as we say in these parts, isn't your first rodeo, did you have any idea that this would be as timely as it's turned out to be with what's going on in our world right now?
Frankly, I didn't. One of the points that I make in the book is that Russia has the capacity and the inclination to challenge the West. This is something that the Kremlin wants to do and has been doing. I think Vladimir Putin has been very consistent from his very first day's power. I think we're only coming to realize that now. You know, I couldn't have predicted that Russia would invade the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea, but I'm not surprised.
What is so valuable about Crimea to Russia?
That's a very good question. I think, you know, Russians would say that, or at least the Kremlin would say that this was historically a part of Russia. It was only given to Ukraine when both Russia and Ukraine were Soviet republics during the Cold War in the 1950s, that Russia has for centuries maintained its Black Sea port of Sevastopol there, the home of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. And a whole host of other reasons that invaded Crimea in order to, well, actually, Russia never admitted to invading Crimea. It says that it was invited in by the locals, of course, the Moscow-installed locals, to protect the safety and rights of Russian speakers, who make up the majority there, from the new authorities in, well, in Ukraine, in the capital, Kiev, who were installed after basically a revolution, got rid of the old pro-Moscow administration. But I think it has much more symbolic importance. Russia is really trying to show that it is the master of its space, the former Soviet space, and it's playing a very 19th century game of power politics by invading an independent country, a neighbor. And I think this is very much to do with Russia's confrontation with the West. Vladimir Putin has been waging for years now a confrontation with the West, which basically enables him to position himself as somebody who is restoring Russia's greatness in the world, something that really appeals to many Russians' nostalgia for the past, for the lost superpower status. And among the core conservative voters to whom Putin is speaking with such actions, it's popular, and that's helped keep him in power for 14 years.
Gregory Pfeiffer is our guest. The book is called Russians, The People Behind the Power. It's from 12 books. And, you know, I sense in reading this book from your own personal history, your mother was raised in that country in the old USSR, in fact, and your father met her there in the early 60s. Stop me when I'm wrong, but just a beautiful gal, seeing the picture of her that you published in the book. But I sense that this book for you was a frustrating labor of love. I sensed your frustration with your mother's homeland. Russia seems to me, and I've never really looked into Russia before. You know, we see Russia in the headlines. This is my first time delving into it through your work. But it seems like a rather bewildering place for many reasons. Could you expound on that?
Well, I think so. And I think you really get to the heart of why I wrote this book. I spent about 8 years living there. I traveled across the entire country. And I really wanted to explain why is it that 2 decades after the Soviet collapse, why do Russians continue to be such a great mystery to Americans and foreigners in general? We can't understand why Russians would continue to support the authoritarian Vladimir Putin, as I said, 2 decades after the Soviet collapse, somebody who's destroyed democracy, overseen a huge explosion of corruption, and really sort of blackened his country's image in the world. Does that really mean that they've learned nothing from their very painful past? And I have to say that my approach has been to look at Russians' behavior, their daily lives, their family life, work habits, drinking. And what seems the case to me is that although Russians' way of doing things may seem chaotic to us, it's very successful at achieving its own aims. Now, these aren't Western aims. I don't think Russians' values and motives are similar to ours. They're different. And that's something that we have to understand. But the behavior is based on very practical reasons. And we have to understand those reasons in order to not only to understand Russia, but also to formulate a response to what's going on now.
So when you say motives and values, could you expound on that of the Russian people?
Sure. Just give you an example. The conventional wisdom is that Putin has ruled according to an unwritten social contract, the idea that as long as living standards continue rising, thanks to the wealth generated by Russia's vast energy resources, its oil and gas, that pretty much people are okay with the Kremlin being as authoritarian as it wants. I don't believe that's the case. I think that the real glue binding Putin's regime to the Russian people is corruption. Now, Russia is a hugely corrupt country. I mean, we know that the Sochi Olympic Games very recently cost $50 billion, the most expensive games in history. We know that $7 billion, or around $7 billion, of the construction money went to companies connected to one man alone, who happened to be Putin's childhood friend. This gives you an idea of the kind of corruption at the top, but it's everywhere. All Russians, or I would say most Russians, pay bribes. Bribery is a part of daily life. You drive a car, you know that you will be stopped by the traffic police, and you know that you'll only be let off if you pay a bribe. If you're the owner of a corner store, for example, you have to bribe the health inspector, the building code inspector, the fire safety inspector. Bribery is very useful to the Kremlin because it enables the authorities to prosecute almost anybody, so it coerces people, but it also co-opts people because it gives people a sense that they have a stake in the system because you get something out of it in return. If you're that corner store owner, for example, and you pay the local police to ensure that no harm comes to your business, maybe you feel that you've got something over on the competition a couple blocks down the street.
That just seems remarkable. And when I read that in the book, that this is their way of life, and I think the way you phrased it was, it's almost as if it's a pragmatic way of life to them. It's so ingrained. It's such a part of what they do. This is how you get along or go along to get along, to pay these bribes, to do these things. Whereas we would look at that and say, wait a second, that sounds like mafia stuff that happens in some of our big cities. And you say there, hey, this is average, ordinary life for those folks.
Sure. And I think part of the reason is can be explained but just by looking at the country's physical characteristics. It's the world's largest country by territory, and also where much of the land is uninhabitable. It's frozen tundra, it's marshland, it's sort of scrubby forest where it's very, very difficult to survive. On top of that, you've got a very, very legendarily cold winter. And I think that that's helped shape Russian behavior. I think that, for example, there's an idea that the basic unit for survival, for human survival, has to be groups of people, whether it's the family or the village or the farm. People have to stay together to help each other in times of need. And this has reinforced the idea that people acting alone are weak, that even the rash actions of the individual can sometimes threaten the well-being of the entire group. So I think this has sort of reinforced this the suspicion of individualism and also a kind of fatalism. It's well known that Russian health is very bad and often wonder why they don't do much about it. This is a country where alcoholism is rampant. A fifth of Russian men die from alcohol-related causes. I think part of the reason is the feeling that one person acting alone can't do very much in the world.
Yeah, and what's sad is these folks have been under this authoritarian, and it's come in all shapes and sizes, and it's called different things than it was in the past in terms of what you want to call the form of governance. But yet these folks are still, at the end of the day, I see Russian people as almost a helpless and almost a hapless society, even though they've given us so much. And you make this point, they've given us so much in terms of art and some of the other great contributions that they've made to the world through science and some of the other things that they've done, yet they come across as a real hapless people in your book. Am I wrong in seeing it that way?
You could characterize it that way. I would say sort of tragic. I think Russians know very much the society that they live in. They're well aware of what the Kremlin is doing. You know, one of the points I make is that I don't think that despite the deep continuities in Russian life, that Russia has fated to be the way it is. I think, as I said, it's based on this practical system, successful in achieving its own aims, and that doesn't mean that it can't change. I think one of the things that Putin has done very successfully is to basically come to power by resurrecting a very traditional political culture after a decade of essentially westernizing reform in the 1990s. And according to this culture, Russian leaders rule by essentially hiding what goes on inside the Kremlin behind bluster, sort of lying essentially, and facades. Now, some of these facades are created by westernizing, by adopting Western forms. For example, the laws of Catherine the Great, which she claimed were based on European Enlightenment thought, were much less enlightened than she said. Soviet communism, another example, would have astounded Marx the way it was implemented. The best example under Putin was the former president Dmitry Medvedev, who sort of warmed his seat for 4 years after Putin had to step down after his first two-term limit expired. You know, people in the West spent the 4 years of his presidency guessing when this man would assume the vast powers of his office. Of course, he never did, because his main role was to obscure what was really going on, and that was that Putin was very much still in control behind the scenes. So I think that our mistake is to look at Russian institutions that seem westernized and to rhetoric, what politicians like Vladimir Putin say, and to take them at face value when they're really meant to deceive, and that's something they've done very successfully.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that, because as I was reading your book, I was thinking, well, surely that kind of crushing of dissent, some of the things that you paint in your book, I'm having the thought, well, surely that's not going on today. And you're saying, well, actually, it's going on today more so now than perhaps it has in a long time. As we visit today with Gregory Pfeiffer, he is a gentleman who's written a book called Russians, The People Behind the Power. It's from 12 books. I'd encourage you to check it out. As you're interviewed around our country, and I know you've been on several shows, I've heard you on a couple, and it's always great to hear you, and it's really wonderful to read this book. Give me, if you can, perhaps a couple of misconceptions about Russia that you've encountered from folks who do what I do.
I think one of the main ones, again, that we look at Russia and we can't figure out what's going on. Vladimir Putin is this kind of a caricature of an aging dictator, and we can't understand why he's popular, especially for cracking down against the opposition, for waging a war against Russia's gays, essentially a sort of a culture war, jailing dissidents. And the fact is that these things are popular. I think that's something that we often overlook. So when Putin does these kinds of things, it makes sense for him to do that. Another is his nationalism. Russians, I think, are very nostalgic for the loss of Soviet superpower status, as I was saying. So when Putin invades Ukraine or threatens to direct nuclear missiles at Western Europe, these things are popular because it's seen as sort of restoring Russia's might in the world. And unfortunately, Putin looks for his models of foreign policy to the Soviet Union. I think for Putin, to be feared and loathed in the world means to be respected. He equates those things. And again, what makes sense to him, what makes him popular among his base of voters, makes him very unpopular in the West. And seen in those terms, what he's doing is actually successful. Now, is it good for Russia in the long term? No, it's isolating Russia from the international community. He's done nothing to diversify Russia's economy from its great dependence on oil and gas, to build industries, to build infrastructure. I would say pretty much everything he's doing is bad for Russia and Russians in the long term, but good for his popularity and his rule in the short term.
So short term, long term, next 15, 20 years, does he again kick the rule over to someone else? They play a shell game for 4 years, and then he returns, or someone that's in his line returns? How is this going to play out with Putin long term?
I think very, very difficult to say. Of course, this is one of the main questions in Moscow right now. How long Putin will stick around? Is he going to run for another six-year term, which means he could be around till 2024? He would be the longest-serving Russian leader since Joseph Stalin. Mm. Or will he hand over power? I don't think anybody knows. I think he'd probably want to stick around for as long as he can. But there are definitely pressures growing on him. Now, I was saying before that I don't believe Russia is fated to remain the same. The society, however slowly it is changing, Russians have the internet, more and more Russians travel abroad. Influences are slowly creeping in from the West. And another big factor, I think, is the economy. As I was saying, Russia's dependence on its energy exports is growing at a time that economic growth as a whole is slowing down in Russia. And this is something that's very worrying to the Kremlin, and I think partly explains some of the increasing authoritarianism that's cracked down for the past year or so. I think they really want to make sure to control all levers in power. In 2005, Russia could balance federal budget if oil was around $20 a barrel. Today, it has to be around $103. Now, the price for Russian oil is a few dollars above that. So the Kremlin is looking at with these oil prices, at the fluctuating energy market now, at the changing natural gas market, as new sources are being opened up thanks largely to fracking around the world. I think the Kremlin sees this as a threat, and I think there's a sense that we really don't know what's going to happen over the next few years.
It's remarkable, and your book is so timely, as we said before, as we visit with Gregory Pfeiffer. The book is called Russians, The People Behind the Power. It's from 12 books. And a word about Greg, first of all, he's a former Moscow correspondent with NPR, and he's reported from Russia for over a decade. Early in the book, you talk about how you were there back in the early 1990s, and then you revisited or returned and were there for a while. And you were received differently. Can you elaborate on that?
That's right. In the 1990s, there was this great optimism that Russia, having thrown off communism, was going to join the rest, become an ally of Western countries and share in their prosperity. Of course, we know that's not what developed. And even though after a decade of westernizing reform under Boris Yeltsin, after Vladimir Putin came to power almost exactly at the same time, oil prices, oil is Russia's major export in the world, started rising, and Russia started raking in a lot of money. So there was this sort of great dismay among Western observers, including me, that now Russia was finally prospering, and yet it seemed to be getting more and more nationalistic, more and more confrontational. And again, my book was an attempt to try to explain this. As a Westerner myself, I'm often mystified by this. The country is, in many ways, looks rich. We had the Sochi Olympic Games. We've got Russia now invading Ukraine. If you go to Moscow, you'll see a city that is pretty wealthy. I mean, there are huge traffic jams with luxury cars, fancy restaurants opening up all the time. And yet if you drive 30 miles or even less outside of Moscow, you'll see a countryside that is literally dying, people leaving, industry collapsing. You know, I visited villages where there were one or two elderly people left living on a muddy track, what used to be a village. I remember distinctly after visiting one of these places, doing a story for NPR about this, and in the evening I had dinner with a local journalist, a young woman who was essentially risking her neck, if not her career, to report on some of the corruption and the mismanagement that had led to the decline of her region. And I said, "Well, look, aren't you angry at Putin for abolishing your right to elect your governor? Well, wouldn't you want to vote somebody else in who could do it differently?" Now, Putin had abolished regional elections in favor of Kremlin appointments. And, you know, her response was to look at me as if I were half mad. She said, "You know, we all know that democracy only enables sort of crooks and sort of mafia dons to take power by false advertising and spending lots of money." And I was really shocked to hear from somebody like this, the government line, almost word by word, that however bad it is, the state knows better. Now, I think some of that has to do with state propaganda, because the state television, the state news sources just spew out Kremlin propaganda. But I think it also speaks to some of the shared assumptions that Russians have.
And I could hear you wrestling within the pages of that book as you say, "Hey, I'm greeted differently. I'm seen differently. The West isn't seen as favorably by the populace, by folks like her who should know better." At some point, you kind of say to yourself, and I'm going to ask you, what do we do about this? Is there anything we can do?
Well, I completely agree with you. Increasingly, over the past few years, there's a sense that among many Russians that the United States' main interest is to see Russia on its knees, that Americans don't want to see a prosperous Russia. I think this is the line very much we're getting from Vladimir Putin now over Ukraine. I mean, he's saying that Americans encourage fascists to take over, and that you know, he often says that America wants to overthrow the government in order to steal Russia's energy resources. I mean, it's absolutely crazy, but it's something that Russians really seem to buy. And yeah, it was a noticeable change. Basically, around 2005, I really noticed that going out with Russians, going out to parties, even with people whom I could before always speak openly, now I really had to watch what I said about, you know, when I was criticizing the authorities. I think that the best way we can counter this is essentially standing up for our values and interests. I think that one of the reasons that Putin made the decision to invade Ukraine was that when he did the same to Georgia in 2008, the international response was very, very weak. Western countries were eager to get back to business as usual with Russia. They didn't want to stick their necks out. And I think that the Kremlin saw this as a sign of great victory. Here, it invaded an independent country, a former Soviet republic, but an ally of the U.S., a country that wanted very much to join NATO, and he put a stop to that by invading it and got away with it. So there was no response. I think now we really, you know, the Western the world, Europe and the U.S., have to enact sanctions. They have to isolate Putin diplomatically in order to, as I was saying, really give the message to Russians that they really need to question what Putin is doing for the long-term future of their country. And we can only do so if we, the Western world, act in a united way, so that this is a message that is reinforced by many countries.
It's one thing what you say. It's another thing altogether what you do. And let me ask you this. If the U.S. doesn't act with the authority that you're looking for, do you believe that some of these other former Soviet countries that have broken away, can they expect to get a visit sometime in the not-too-distant future? It looks from the outside looking in like, hey, it's time to put the team back together here. What do you think?
Right, my masked soldiers with no insignia. I think it is a real threat. I don't think that he would be able to resurrect the Soviet Union. I think it's, and I don't think we're seeing a new Cold War. Russia doesn't, as President Obama rightly said, Russia doesn't lead a bloc of countries behind it. It doesn't stand for an ideology that is trying to spread in the world. It's basically a regional power that's trying to throw its weight around. But I do think that if it feels it's successful in Ukraine, that it will look to other countries as well. I think the first one would be Moldova, another former Soviet republic right next to Ukraine, where there is basically a small sliver of it that is a breakaway pro-Moscow region. And I think that Putin could very easily essentially invade again and snatch away this territory. That's a real concern. There are Russian troops now massing on Russia's western border. I think he could also try to threaten the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, also former Soviet republics, but now also members of NATO and the European Union. And I think that would risk some kind of confrontation with the West, of course, because these are NATO members and would be any threat to their security would be countered by other NATO countries. So yes, there definitely is a risk, and I think that it's important to act now because it may be even more difficult to act in the future.
As we visit today with Gregory Pfeiffer, Russians, the people behind the power. It's from 12 books, wherever fine books are sold. And let me tell you something. You pick this thing up, you're going to learn an awful lot about that place, the culture, the people, the history. And he goes way back and talks about the terrain there, the way those are hard-scrabbled folks that live in that land who may not want things to be the way they are, even though it appears from the outside that they do want things the way that they are. A couple of asides. First of all, what did you think of the not-too-distant Olympics that were just completed and the coverage in this country of Putin, of what's going on in Russia by the U.S. press?
I think that attention to Russia's human rights record, of course, Russia criticized this. I think it was perfectly justifiable. I think any time that reporters in Russia are writing about, reporting on some of these pressing issues facing not only Russian opposition figures, but, you know, any normal sort of ordinary person who would criticize the Kremlin, I think that's good. I think there was a little bit of over-the-top coverage of toilets not functioning or not constructed well. But I think that's the kind of thing that you see ahead of every Olympic Games. I mean, the recent London Summer Games, which were universally touted as very successful, and the run-up to them, the coverage was very negative about security concerns, about how traffic was going to be tied up. So I think that kind of stuff is inevitable. I think that the Olympic Games, it was a big deal in Russia because more than just essentially showcase Russia on the world stage, I think they were very successful for that for Russia. I see them as a very typical Russian phenomenon. This sort of grandiose project made a great sacrifice in order to show that Russia is catching up to the West. And like many projects in the past, the Soviets built a railroad across Siberia. It still hasn't been built. It's not clear why it was being built, but just to show Russian capabilities. I think this was one of these projects, and I think, like these other projects, far from heralding a new era of progress, I think they showed just how much Russia lags the West. Poverty is rife, alcoholism, disease is rampant. In many ways, this is a country heading toward crisis, and I think that it was good that the Olympic Games were occasion where the world took notice.
Yeah, in fact, you could say that their whole reason for having the Olympics there sort of backfired on those in the Kremlin. And page 51 of your book really paints a bleak picture. Three times more Russian folks die of heart disease than their American or European counterparts. How about life expectancy? 64 years of age, and you say by world tables, that's 166th in our world. Is that correct?
It's pretty bad. Now, male life expectancy, which was, I think it was 58 until recently, has started to edge up, but it's still very, very low. And yeah, I mean, the country faces these tremendous problems. And I think, again, we look at Putin as somebody who is sort of represents Russia and Russians, of course, he's the president. But so many things he's doing are harmful to the long-term future of the country, as I was saying. All of these pressing problems, not only just the health problem, but the decaying infrastructure, the dependence on oil and gas, the relations with Russia's neighbors. It should be in Russia's interest, it is in Russia's interest, to have a prosperous, independent, secure Ukraine. This is a large country and right on Russia's southern border. They should be allies. They should be encouraging trade ties and cultural ties. This is a country where most of the people speak Russian, where you're just as often to hear Russian being spoken on the streets of the capital than you are Ukrainian. And that's true for so many other countries. Kazakhstan, countries in Central Asia, used to be true in the Baltic states. And instead of encouraging these ties, Russia seems to be doing everything possible to alienate these countries, make them feel insecure, to undermine their stability, because the Kremlin sees that as the way of increasing Russia's influence and pressuring these countries, when in the long run, Russia is really losing these ties because people increasingly don't want to speak Russian. They see it as a threat. And so, yeah, I mean, for the long term, all this is very bad and not positive news for Russia's future.
Yeah, and it's obviously a place that you care about and you feel an affinity for the people there. And Gregory, again, I want to thank you for your work. Thanks for joining us today. On the way out, please, I want to give you the opportunity to have the final word. If you want to retouch on a point or perhaps introduce something new, I'd like to do this with all our guests. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. I would just say that my main point in the book is that Russia is not as mysterious as it seems, that we often look at Russia and see it as a riddle or try to explain it away by saying that Russians have some kind of mysterious soul that's unknowable because it's different. And I really believe that that's really not the case, that Russians act for practical reasons, and we just have to understand what those are.
Hey, I really want to thank you again, Gregory. Great talking with you.
Thanks so much.
Hey, check out Russians from Gregory Pfeiffer. The People Behind the Power, it's from 12 books, and I thank Gregory Pfeiffer again for appearing.